any of us who've been in it for long enough, our entire career has been littered with jobs that we didn't get, projects that we thought were going to go for sure, dozens of unproduced scripts littering the floor.
All of us are running into both major and minor failures in Hollywood every single day.
For every success, there is months, sometimes even years, of painful failure.
This is one of the only businesses I can think of where failure is the default. That's the norm. You have to be able to persevere.
Like everything in our business, your hands get calloused and it all bounces off you. That process takes years. That doesn't happen overnight.
I was being told by my manager, it's yours to lose. And I promptly lost it. And I remember thinking like, well, that's it for me. I blew my one big shot. What I've realized from that moment is it's never one big shot. There will be other shots.
Screaming into the Hollywood Abyss is brought to you by Scriptation, the Emmy award-winning app that instantly transfers your notes into new drafts in seconds. Scriptation allows you to digitally mark up scripts, separate notes into layers, track changes across revisions, and so much more. Insert Noah saying something nice about Scriptation.
Dan, I think this is where they actually want me to talk about how much I love it. And I do love it. It's great. Its collating function transformed me from the messiest writer in Hollywood to, well, ever so slightly less messy. My wife might have other things to say about that. Scriptation listeners can get a free month of Scriptation by going to scriptation.com/Scriptation.
For those of you who don't understand slightly drawly American accents, that's scriptation.com/SITHA. Welcome back to Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss, a podcast about rejection, failure, and adversity in the entertainment industry. I am, as ever, your non-entertainment co-host, Dan Rutstein.
And I am your still in the entertainment business co-host, Noah Evslin. On today's podcast, I'm thrilled to introduce writer, producer, and director Mark Benedou to the podcast. He both directed and produced such feature films as Sinner, as well as produced the feature film He Went That Way, starring Jacob Elordi and Zach Quinto, out in theaters now and will be available on demand tomorrow. Mark is accompanied by his producing partner, Hugh Broder, also the producer of He Went That Way and Emoticon, amongst others. Welcome, Mark and Hugh.
Okay. Hello. Hello. How you doing?
So, look, thank you very much for coming on. So I should reveal before this starts that Mark and I are friends, so we may gang up. I don't know actually what Mark's relationship with Hugh is like, but I'm definitely going to be mean to Noah and Mark and gentler with Hugh, and obviously Mark's English as well. So 50% of this podcast will be done at a high intellectual and politeness level. So, gentlemen, thank you very much for coming on. So this is the second time we've had people on sort of almost more specifically about a particular film. So sort of more of a sort of case study in how to get something made. So I think the place to start is your movie is obviously it's based on a true story and quite a sort of unlikely true story. So can you give us let's start with Hugh, actually, if you don't mind. Hugh, can you give us the sort of the 90-second elevator pitch on your new movie, and then we'll sort of take it from there?
I can. We like to say, imagine a story about a ice skating chimpanzee and his trainer who happen to just be driving across the country and pick up a fellow who has just murdered three people. And the relationship that ensues over the next couple of days of driving from Las Vegas to Kalamazoo, Michigan.
When you've got monkeys and serial killers, chimpanzees and serial killers,
I'm glad you corrected yourself.
Yes, thank you for correcting that.
Yeah.
Because the difference between a monkey and a chimpanzee is that a monkey has a tail and a chimpanzee doesn't.
So did you know that before shooting this?
Hell no.
Yeah, no, but that's the beauty of being in the business we're in. You learn something new on every production, and that's what we took away from this one, among other things.
And I think this is right, because there is a lot in here. There is obviously, there is killing in the movie itself, obviously, but one of the things we're going to touch on later on, there were actually some deaths during production as well. But just in terms of the serial killer part of this, there were some prison visits as part of getting sort of working out how BAFTA tell this story. Let's start with some prison visits and let's see where we get to from there.
So the genesis of this film started with a book I had found 19 years ago while in a used bookstore back home in Michigan. And it happened to have been written by my freshman year poetry professor. But when I saw it, its spine on the bookshelf, I didn't recognize the title as one of his books of poetry. So I pulled it off the shelf, and all of a sudden I'm reading about two brothers who are serial killers who did not participate in each other's crimes. And oh, by the way, about the woman who was married to both of them at separate times. And oh, by the way, the one brother adopting the other brother's children while they were both in prison. And this one little four-page chapter called Mike and the Chimpanzee, which is what the movie eventually became, because the story, Mark and I had dreams of telling the whole family's story, but you're not going to do that in a 90-minute movie. And I got a little bit ahead of myself because you asked about the prison interviews. The book had used all pseudonyms for all these guys because my poetry professor, who's now writing about serial murderers and what makes them tick, had gotten a grant from the college to write this book back in the 70s. And with the understanding that he would use pseudonyms, he actually interviewed in prison both brothers because they were still in prison in the 70s. This was in the 70s now. And he interviewed the woman that was married to both of them. And when I told Mark about the story, he said, can we go, do you still stay in touch with your professor? Well, I hadn't. We got in touch with him. He invited us up and he basically handed us his boxes of research, which included these interviews he had done 30 years earlier. So we got to listen to these two guys tell their story. And then, of course, we only told the story of the three-day journey across the United States. But yeah, we still have the interviews.
Extraordinary. I mean, look, 19, I think the episode we did just before Christmas was it took somebody 17 years from their first meeting to getting the film made. So you win by 2 years. 19 years is a long time, obviously. Presumably there were many occasions where you thought this would never get made.
Yeah, I mean, I'll jump in, Mark, and I know I'm talking a lot, but the one thing I did want to say when you started talking about the years, here's the great irony for us. The movie came out on January 5th, you know, obviously 2024. It was January 5th, 2005, that Mark and I sat at a dinner on that production in Copenhagen, and I told him this story. So it really was 19 years in the making. And it literally was, well, let's do something with that. Mark, I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because, you know, I was producing commercials at the time and Hugh was an agency producer. And commercials, you know, you have a production company producer, an agency producer, and you work, you know, hand in hand together to, you know, to produce the commercial. And I just finished directing a movie called Sinner. And we were talking about, you know, what I was going to do next. And I asked Hugh, you know, has he read anything interesting? And he told me about this book, Luke Karamazov. And so, you know, it was a really interesting process. And, you know, as Hugh mentioned, we flew to Kalamazoo. We met Conrad. We went to all the places that, you know, featured in the book. And then we felt that it was such an incredible story between these two brothers and that it was such a screwed up upbringing that both of them had. And, you know, evaluating that, you know, them both of them being serial killers, we figured well, there was a, you know, psychologist that figured out that, you know, one was born a serial killer and one became a serial killer. And so we thought that's a really interesting premise to, you know, to hang on to make the movie. We then tried, I mean, yes, it took 19 years, but it wasn't like a solid 19 years of trying, you know. We then tried to get the book set up, you know, making a movie, as everyone knows, it's all about the timing. We couldn't get it set up, and then we put it aside for a couple of years, and we tried again, and we couldn't get it set up. And we, then we sort of, you know, figured that we would take this one chapter, Mike and the Chimpanzee, try to get that written as a screenplay. And we managed to find a very talented writer, Evan Wiener, who just written something called Monogamy. And he wrote that. Then we tried to set that up, and that didn't get set up. And then we sort of put it aside. And in the meantime, we're doing our sort of, you know, our other jobs. You know, I'm producing commercials and TV, and Hugh's doing, you know, his agency work as well. And so then we came back to it. And then I think it was about 2017, we were like, okay, we have just got to do this. This is getting silly. You know, this story needs to be told. And then in 2019, you know, I had a family tragedy. My son was killed by a drunk driver. And I kind of sort of ducked out of commercials. I'm like, I can't really, you know, handle this anymore. I want to just do a film, and I just want to tell this story. And then Hugh and I sort of sat down and we thought, okay, what are we going to do? A friend of mine is a financier in London. He has a company called Headgear. I went to school with him. And, you know, I was talking to him and I said, you know, Phil, I really would like to make this movie. And he said, well, let me try and help you. And then at that point, it sort of, you know, the process started working pretty quickly. And, you know, 2019 to now, you know, it still feels like it's a long time, because during that time, we then had to go out to cast. We then had to get it financed. We then had to, you know, find a director. And, you know, we then had to wait for the director, for the actors to be free, you know, their schedules. And then eventually, I mean, we didn't shoot the movie until the end of 2021. But it wasn't plain sailing, because, you know, Jeff was a first time director, even though he was a super experienced commercial director. Right. He would have been a first time feature director. So that just kind of added, you know, added another issue to it. But go ahead.
For clarity's sake, we'll separate this a little bit from pre-production into production, because this is sort of a fascinating story and some backstory between Dan and I. Dan had texted me one night as we're kind of trying to figure out our guests for the coming year. And he's like, you know, I think he calls it footy. I play footy with somebody, or football, or definitely not soccer, with somebody who has this fascinating story, 20-year journey of telling this, of making this movie, and all of these things went wrong along the way. You know, I think this would be a good guest. And I was like, yeah, that does sound fascinating. And as I'm hearing you guys tell this story, what's resonating with me as a longtime writer is that you stuck with it. I mean, so many people, before you even get to principal photography, which I'm sure is its own whole thing, people would have off-ramped. You know, you can't get it set up, they're gone. Most producers are gone. You write a script, it doesn't get set up, most producers are gone. You guys are deciding, for whatever reason, to keep this thing going. Then 2019 comes around, it sounds like, which is also COVID, where you're finally getting the money and the world goes into quarantine. So at some point, you know, you guys get a director named Jeff and you guys go into principal photography. Were you convinced the movie was going to happen? And I mean, was there doubt still until you started shooting, or were you guys just in your head? Like you said, you'd mentioned final songs. You knew this movie was going to get made. It just was a matter of when.
I mean, it's a good point. Just to step back on it, the reason we just kept on is that the story, the premise is so fascinating and so bizarre that it's just too good not to be able to tell it. And I think the thing is, you know, yes, there was COVID, and yes, there was financing issues, and yes, we had to worry about certain, you know, reaching certain casts and getting the right cast and getting our money. But at the end of the day, we just knew that this story was so bizarre that it had to be told. And, you know, I've read thousands of scripts over the years, and I'm sure you have heard hundreds of stories. But this one story just would not go away in our minds. And, you know, this Hugh and I just kept talking about it every single time we would, you know, we would catch up.
This is also fascinating. And you know, people, you know, wonder online, come talk to me, you know, like, how does a movie get made? I mean, like, it's just so hard all along the way. So many people say no. And yet it sounds like how a movie gets made is you have two producers like the two of you who just stick with it, who decide this movie is going to get made and we're going to make it no matter what happens. So why don't we go into the start of production? Because I heard things started to go sideways there as well. What were you doing as producers to keep this movie on the tracks? And where are some places that this movie started to like fall off the tracks and you guys had to adjust to keep this thing going?
Go ahead, Hugh.
It's hard to know some of the exact moments, but you know, in my memory, obviously, once Jeff was into it, we sort of felt that perhaps, you know, because Jeff and Mark are in LA, I'm in New York, we all work with people who do films, we're always rubbing elbows with DPs, this, that, and the other thing, people who are all in the movies, that you start telling people about this, it starts to gain a little bit of his own momentum. Mark and Jeff were with a production company who had done longer length things. We thought we could leverage that. But, you know, the minute you start talking about, well, do you guys have any money? That's the first place it goes off the rails. Because, no, we didn't. You know, not to be deterred, however, you know, Jeff had a lot of contacts in the Australian film community because that's where he's from, and also worked back there, I should say. And he started reaching out to people there. Mark, as he said, reached out to the financier in London. How do we do this? I really want to do this. The one moment that was a plus was when I think it was Jeff who brought us Jacob. Am I right, Mark? I think, or Jeff had a contact. Somebody knew.
No, I think what it was is our financier sent it to a sales agent to basically.
That's what it was.
Yeah. Ask them what they thought of the script. And the sales agent thought, this is an incredible script.
Right.
I read a script as good as this for a while. Then let's get it to a casting director. And the casting director read it and loved it. And she said, this would be great. There's a couple of really good young actors that could play Larry Raines, a serial killer. And one of which is this really hot guy from a TV series called Euphoria. You may or may not have heard of it. And we were like, yeah, I've heard of it, you know, but, and we'll send it to him. And then we'll send it to a couple of other people for the role of Jim, which is the role that Zach Quinto played. Literally, I think it was sent to like four people. And both Jacob and Zach said yes, they loved it, they wanted to talk to us. And then Jacob spoke to Jeff, the director.
That's what it was.
Momentum started, sort of, you know, the ball rolling. However, it's great to have these two actors attached, but we still at that point had no money. So then they had to take it to Cannes, and they, you know, they took it to the market at Cannes, tried to pre-sell it. You know, we sold the rest of the world to Universal. And that still left like a huge gap because, you know, with the, you know, when you go and do a movie as independent as it is, or as it turned out, you know, you still have these inflated sort of, you know, dreams of doing, you know, having a bigger budget, you know. So our budget was, you know, it was a $10 million movie at one point. And, you know, that whittled down, you know, as the process, you know, as you get the no's and as you get the, you know, the obstacles thrown at you. So in the end, you know, and we had like a 50-day shoot. In the end, we shot the movie very, very low budget. We shot it in 17 days, you know. So it was, you know, it was a process, but you have to go through that process because you're not going to say, okay, no, fuck that. I'm not going to do that now. Just, you know, the ball is already rolling and the train has left the station. And you, as a producer, you have to keep everything on track and you just have to, I wouldn't say compromise. People use the word compromise. Compromise is not the right word. You just have to use a business head and you just have to say, yeah, it's the business and this is what we're going to have to do. And whether or not, you know, we really want to do it, we've got to find the best way to do it, you know? So that's kind of our process. And I was in LA and Hugh was in New York and, you know, we worked out a way of sort of, you know, communicating on a daily basis. Hugh's speciality in New York was on the post-production side, and my speciality was on the production side. So there was this beautiful sort of, you know, a sort of symbiosis of being able to have like really savvy production. I mean, you know, we've both been doing this for a very, very long time, and we know how to do things. You know, there were certain times where people would say, can you do this or should we do this? And, you know, especially from the director, you know, that's the other thing you have to do as a producer. You have to give the director as much as he wants, but you still have to make him stay within the guidelines that you have. And that is, you know, the way you do that best is by having built a relationship with that person, you know, and Jeff, and a level of respect.
So just a question about the actors. So obviously it's a blessing and a curse when you get big names, because their diaries are full because they're shooting other things and they're in demand. And also, I mean, I can only imagine, you know, the not so much necessarily them, depending on what they're like, but, you know, they're people. Once their people get involved in terms of, you know, how big a font their names need to be in the posters and timings to get them available for the junkets and all that stuff must be complicated. But, you know, when you're working with somebody, so obviously, like, Zach Quinto's been in, you know, I imagine that the budget for probably the last season of Heroes was probably higher than your movie for each episode, probably.
No doubt.
But I feel like Star Trek would have had a reasonable size budget. So, you know, when you're working with people who have been part of much bigger things, but, you know, obviously they're now in your relatively small movie, but, you know, they want to be in it because it's a great story and they want to tell it. You know, what's it like sort of working with them? Do you spend all your time apologizing that their trailers aren't bigger? Or, you know, how do you operate with them?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, the key word that you said earlier is the word want. You know, once an actor commits, wants to be in your movie, and they understand what level the movie is, you know, and certainly in our experience, it was very pleasant. There was no stomping feet saying, I need to have, you know, a motorhome, or I need to have this, or I need to have that. Both Zach and Jacob were the consummate professionals. And I think that's what made them. I mean, the thing is, they were both in every scene. So that's what made it so pleasant. You know, they didn't demand anything other than sort of, you know, the sort of a level of professionalism that was going to allow them to give us the best performances. So, you know, there would definitely be times where, you know, if something wasn't right, they would ask for something. And if we could do it, we would do it. And if we couldn't, we would say no. And to be honest with you, it's almost like it's a bit of a dance at the beginning with the negotiation with their teams and their agents. You know, it's like a fight. You know, you're in a boxing ring with their reps and everyone. And then once the fight is decided, once the decision has been made, everyone falls into line really quickly, which was, you know, it was a learning process for us again. But we didn't have any issues, and after everyone committed and sort of, you know, said we're going to do this, you know. I mean, you hear of horror stories where that changes, but we were very lucky. We were, you know, a small movie. We didn't have a huge cast, but they, you know, as big as Jacob is now and was becoming, and as experienced as Zach was, you know, they never did anything that was kind of unprofessional. So it was a great experience.
Try and find the right way to ask this question. So I'm gonna just ask the question. So look, we had I think Noah. It was Stephen D'Souza on the podcast, and I remember he sort of casually dropped in that a couple of his big movie projects failed because I think the financier on one was killed in a car crash at like quite early on, and there was another one. Like he had a couple of sort of casually dropped in a couple of deaths that have affected some of his project, but it was very much sort of, he didn't go into a lot of detail. But I think in a very different way, you had two deaths as part of this story, one very much linked to obviously the movie itself, and one linked, Mark, to your personal life. I'd just be interested, maybe Hugh, if you start with the with one, and then Mark talk about the other. Just, you know, trying to do a hard thing like making a movie when these sorts of things are happening in the background, and how it changes how you think about your movie, but also, you know, why you're doing the things that you're doing.
I'm actually going to tell it not the way you would expect me to tell it, so please bear with me. Summer of 19, I took the summer off, and I had gone to northern Wisconsin to revisit my childhood, perhaps, but I worked at a summer camp and taught water skiing for the entire summer. However, when I first got up there, Mark and I were having daily phone calls. At that time, we didn't have financing yet, but we were already into conversations with how to do the chimp. Could we use a live chimp, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I very distinctly remember standing on the boat dock having a conversation with Mark and Jeff and some other folks. And then I sort of went dark for the summer because I just needed whatever, but I figured Mark would reach out to me if necessary. I'm talking about the right year, right, Mark? I turned off all my social media. Mark knows this story. I turned off all of my social media. I woke up, I hadn't heard from Mark for quite some time, you know, a month or two. And I woke up the morning I was leaving to go home. I'd been away for 10 weeks. And I don't know what made me turn on Facebook. And this was August 15th, August 16th, something like that. And the first thing that pops up is Mark's Facebook post about Noah. I mean, I'm in this crappy little cabin in northern Wisconsin. And I almost shut it and went, no, I didn't just see what I just saw. So that was the one, if you will, that we're talking about that hit me the most. I'd met Noah when he was a little kid because I would call Mark up when I was out in LA on other jobs, et cetera, et cetera. We didn't talk for a couple more days till I got home, I think. You know, let the time happen. And I actually, oddly enough, although Dan, you led it with, well, one wasn't really directing, wasn't the movie affected the movie directly. I actually think in a way it's what got this movie made. And because 4 or 5 months after that, I finally had time to talk to Mark and sit down and really talk about things. And the conversation was, as he said earlier in this chat, I'm not ready to go back to work. I don't know if I can, but I need to get this movie made. And it almost became Noah's movie in that sense. And I remember when we were in post-production, I don't think I'm telling stories out of school, Mark. We were doing music. And I called Mark and I said, you know, the music for our closing credits does not have to be from the era. I hate to say this, but I don't hate to say this. Can you find something in Noah's library that would work for our closing sequence? The movie dips to black, and the music you then hear is one of Noah's compositions. And that's where we ended up.
Yeah, that's lovely. Lovely words, Hugh. Thank you. And I think, I think you're absolutely right. Had I not had a terrible tragedy, we probably would still be scrabbling around trying to make the movie. It just was one of those things that it was a defining moment where I've just got to do this and we have to do this. And it was a very tough thing. But for me, jumping in and, you know, making a movie is all consuming, was a way that I was able to step away from the grief that I was suffering and still suffer and be able to concentrate on something to keep me going, you know. And I think the same thing, you know, the second tragedy that we had was, you know, right after we finished filming, Jeff, the director, went back to Sydney where he lives. And he was editing the movie, and we gave him 3 months to edit the movie. And he just, you know, he called us up on, I think it was a, called us up on a Thursday, and he said, I've finished my director's cut. I'm so excited for you to see it. Sent us the director's cut on a Friday. And then on the Sunday, he sadly was drowned in an accident. He went in a paddleboard accident. He went off paddleboarding, had a seizure and drowned. And the irony, and you can't really make this up, that day was actually the anniversary of my son Noah's death, a birthday. So someone called me up and said, oh, you know, I'm very sorry, how are you doing? And I thought they were sort of, you know, talking about me and how I was doing today, because it would have been my son's birthday. And I said, oh, I'm doing okay, thank you for asking. And then they continued, and then they were like, well, Jeff's family must be so upset. And I was like, Jeff's family? What do you mean? And they were like, well, didn't you hear Jeff passed away today? And it was a very bizarre moment. And, you know, these moments, you can never prepare yourself for these moments. And so having a director die, you know, 2 days after he delivered his director's cut, for producers of a movie is a huge issue. It's a problem. And again, we took time to sort of think about, you know, how we approach the next steps. And we then took 6 months. We took our time to kind of finish the movie. Pretty much his cut was, I would say the movie now is like 95% the same cut that Jeff had. You know, we adjusted a few things based upon people's opinions and financiers and some you know, some focus group screenings. But yeah, it was a huge obstacle to get over. So, but you just, I think that, you know, in answer to your question, Dan, you just have to keep going. You know, again, you just can't step off the train, because otherwise it just becomes a, I don't want to say train wreck, but it becomes, you know, it just goes off the rails. And we had a responsibility. We had a fiduciary responsibility to our financiers, and we had a responsibility to Jeff's, you know, legacy, and to, you know, everyone that worked their asses off on the movie. So, you know, you just keep going.
Yeah. Look, thanks for talking about it in that way. I mean, it's I know it's not straightforward. Obviously, Mark and I, you and I speak a lot about this stuff.
Yeah.
But thank you for those answers. And I think it, as you say, the fact that, you know, maybe part of the reason you got it finished, or got it made and then got it finished, is a tribute to them, which makes it all the more powerful. Noah, back to you.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a powerful and emotional story. Thank you both for sharing. And, you know, it's very different, but I was, made me think about, I mean, A, making a movie is impossible. And then you had to deal with your grief on the top of that, which is, you know, two times as impossible. And then making me think about when I had cancer and I still worked, and I asked my employers to give me as much work as possible while I had cancer, which seems counterintuitive, but I didn't want to just spiral in my room. I was immune compromised during COVID. I couldn't go anywhere, and I just wanted to work. And that was just like one baby footstep in front of another was allowing me to just not focus on that my body's destroying itself, you know, with chemo.
I was interested because in our business, what, you know, producers, what we do is what we, you know, we put out fires, we make shit happen. And there's certain times when, you know, you can't, you know, there's certain things that you have zero control over, you know, like a death or like something, you know, something is a force majeure or whatever it might be. But because you're so, you know, you're so conditioned just making it happen and getting it done, you just keep doing it. You just keep moving forward. It's that momentum, you know, and they say, you know, the terrible cliched expression, it takes a village. It really does. It just takes everyone just rallying around and just to keep moving forward.
Yeah. And did it, I guess this is a two-part question. Because I found that after going through something momentous in your own life, everything you're dealing with takes on a whole new, you know, kind of, you're looking at things differently. You're able to handle some things differently because, like, there's other bigger things that are happening in your world. And so what feels like the biggest thing in your life, which is the making of a movie or a TV show, gets somewhat put in perspective. But so I sort of kind of maybe talk a little bit about that. And also, more back in the filmmaking side of things. Earlier on, you said you wanted X amount of money and you didn't get it. And then you had to kind of readjust what your vision was. And then you got 17 days to shoot this thing, but you spent 20 years visualizing it. What ended up being the final product? Was that the thing that was bouncing around in your head? Did it very much change along the way? Are you still, or did you guys get it there? And are you happy with what ended up, hitting the screen?
No, well, first place, let me start from this perspective, right? And I'll make this quick. I'm 11 years old. I'm taken on a tour of the Paramount lot. I get to sit in Captain Kirk's chair from the original Star Trek show. And I look around and I have my Brownie movie camera with me. And I go, my God, this is all fake stuff. I could make a movie back in Detroit. Flash forward 50 some odd years. And also a career in which on every shoot I do, sometimes we get exactly what we need. Sometimes we don't get exactly what we need. Sometimes people in edits are beating it up and you didn't put the best thing on the screen. So I maybe had a little bit lower expectations because I tempered everything with, oh my God, we just made a movie. I'm not saying I had stars in my eyes, and we certainly did. To Mark's point, we messed around with Jeff's rough cut a little bit because we didn't think it had quite gotten there in terms of things we had talked about for 19 years. I have not watched the movie since June 9th. I can't. Because I just, like every commercial I've ever produced in my life, oh gosh, if we had only had another $5,000. Oh gosh, I can't. Story-wise, absolutely thrilled with the decisions we made in the script writing phase, which, embellished creatively, had to put things in to tell the story more succinctly than it really was. Yes, very thrilled that how it came out. I think we got there. And rendering the story, absolutely. But I'm going to guess, knowing my partner, that I'm probably a little less critical than he might be at this point.
I mean, very as a very tame answer, but look, I think, they say when you make a movie, you make five movies, the movie you write, the movie you shoot, the movie you edit, the movie you make changes to, and the movie that goes out, and that's all well and good. And I will go, I will go on record saying I am very, very proud of the movie we've made. I think it's a great movie. I think Jeff did an incredible job. And I think, yes, there may be people that say, oh, well, it wasn't a director's cut, but it's pretty much close. And, he would be very proud of it. And it looks great. And the performances are great. I think the thing for me, which sours it for me, the critics, it's like you never know how it's going to be received. You never know what people are going to look into it. And a lot of the time, the people that are making these judgments on the movie that you've spent a lot of time, a good percentage of your life, they come up with the most ridiculous bullshit and the most ridiculous comments. And that, I think, is the thing that's the most upsetting about the movie. I love the movie. I'm very proud of it. And if I never make another movie again, then okay, I'm good with that. But it's the critics, and it's we've had some great reviews, and we've had some not great reviews. And the not great reviews, I know people say you should not read the reviews and you should not listen to anyone, but it's human nature. You can't not do that. But they hurt. And a lot of them are, a lot of them, I would say 50% of them are people that should know better because they know how to make movies and they know what it takes to get into a movie. And 50% of them are people that shouldn't be commenting on a movie because they know fuck all. So in answer to your question, yes, I think it's great what the outcome, but only time will tell in terms of an audience's reception? And, you know, that's, we'll find out.
and I'll say this, as tame as my reply might have sounded, I too am immensely proud of having made this movie.
Yeah.
And having stuck with the story and how interesting it is. And it does hurt. I mean, and, you know, you have to keep telling yourselves, the good stuff doesn't hurt, of course, but you have to keep telling yourselves that there's also, you know, there's critics and there's trolls. And, you know, it's who's saying what and this, that, and the other thing. And I won't say which newspaper it was, but my 94-year-old mother, who attended the premiere as her first trip after COVID, got on a plane from Detroit and flew to New York, said to me, "Yeah, I read that review. They spelled everybody's name right." And I was like, "You know what? You're right."
That's what mothers are good for. In this day of critics, too, by the way, they don't get press if they give you a good review. They don't get clicks. They get clicks if they give you a bad review. And I do remember, you know, to make you make people feel better who get bad reviews, one of my very first trips to LA, I went to the writer premiere of Pirates of the Caribbean with the writers. And we went to a lunch beforehand, and we spent the entire lunch. They read out loud every terrible review. And this is a blockbuster massive film that people love. So like even that blockbuster film that everybody loves had a number of just god-awful reviews, and read them out loud to all of us.
Yeah. But people, it's like this in this day, sorry, Dan, I just finished in one point. In this day and age, people feel that they can just criticize everyone and everything. I mean, even Jeff, the poor man who's not here to defend himself, there was a couple of reviews that just absolutely pulled him apart, you know, and I was just like, it's just not nice. We're in this age of like everyone just being horrible. It's like time to be nice, time to just appreciate it, time for everyone to see movies. And if you don't like it, it's fine. It's great. It's not going to work for everyone.
Yeah.
Look, you know, as a goalkeeper who spent years playing football with Mark just ahead of me in defence, I know that he does not take criticism very well, justified or not. So look, unfortunately, it's time for the final question. But just before we ask the final question, just two very quick ones, which I want a quick answer to. So the first one is, did you use a CGI or a real chimpanzee in the end?
Neither. We used a combination of a young girl inside an animatronic suit that was created by the Academy Award winning company Legacy Effects. And the little girl was trained by a very famous animal choreographer called Terry Notary, who was her father. And so they spent 6 months, you know, studying the way chimpanzees move. And then she spent 6 hours every day on set having makeup and a headpiece that had, I think it was 170 servo motors in it, that was puppeteered by puppeteers with wireless controllers offset.
That wasn't the answer I was expecting.
I know, right? And that's where most of our money, ironically, that's where most of our money went, you know.
Yeah, I bet.
Again, on that note, real quickly, relating to an earlier question of yours, are you proud of the movie, whatever? This was my moment. I'm on set this week for 7 shooting days with a very good commercial director, and I showed him the trailer, and he turned to me and he goes, "Oh my God, what was it like working with a chimpanzee?" And I was just, "Yes, it worked."
Yeah. So second quick one is, assuming that they've seen it, what does your poetry professor think of the movie, given the genesis?
We didn't even address that. Unfortunately, Conrad died 6 years ago. And however, at one of my college reunions, which I go to every 5 years, very small school, and we always invite, he was a beloved professor at this college. And my class that year, I think this is 10 years ago, invited him to sit with us at the homecoming dinner at our table. So he sits down next to me and he says to me, if I can use the F-bomb, he says to me, "So Hugh, are you and Mark going to ever make that fucking movie?"
Well,
So yes, unfortunately, he didn't get to see it, which kind of bums us out. But you know, it's I think we did him proud too, don't you?
Yeah, definitely.
And he was very interested in the process of making movies. He's a freaking poetry professor.
So now the actual final question. So we ask every guest this question, which is, if you could give one piece of advice to somebody wanting to enter the industry in whatever role, I guess in this case, probably producing, what would that piece of advice be? If you want to go first, Hugh.
I think it's more, I think my answer is sort of short, and it's a little broader than movies in general, but you'll get what I'm saying, which is be nice to everyone, because you just don't know who along that path, you know, might be interested in your project. Share your creativity. You know, invite people into your process, if you will, you know, and that's a little bit meandering, but that's kind of how I feel about it. I mean, a lot of people came to the party for us knowing how much we wanted to make this movie over all these years. And it's all people that, you know, for me, for sure, that I met along the way, including Mark, by the way, from day one, you know, and you know, people who love to make things, make them. They figure it out. I don't know if that's advice as much as experienced, you know.
It's a great answer. I wish somebody had told Noah at the beginning of his career to be nicer to people. That, I think, would have made a big difference to him. Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the one thing you should always do is be honest with yourself and with the process, because you can get yourself caught up in a whole lot of bullshit. And if you can be honest with yourself and honest with the process, you retain your integrity, and then you're able to deal with anything, because if you've got your integrity, you can deal with adversity.
Yeah, great stuff. Look, Mark Benedou and Hugh Broder, thank you very much indeed for coming on the podcast. I'm very excited to see the movie tomorrow. I've heard a lot about it, and I think I'm obliged to say this. I know it's only a very small part in it, but my karate partner gets shot in the head by Jacob at some point. I don't want to give too much away, but my partner, Josh. Thank you both very much for coming on, telling your at times quite painful story, but you know, I'm excited to see the movie, and I know a lot of other people are. So thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, our pleasure. Thanks for having us. This is fun.
Yeah, it was great.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss, brought to you by Scriptation. Thank you, as ever, to James Launch for the music, and thank you to our loyal listeners. And if there's any showrunners out there who want to hear their fellow showrunners abused and ruffled around and put under the microscope so you can hear their stories of rejection, failure, and adversity, please send them our way. If you are interested in following us on social media, no, I've lost track.
I am at Ann Ebslin on Twitter or X or whatever Elon Musk now calls it. And thanks to Elon Musk, I'm also at Noah Ebslin on Hive, Spoutable, Blue Sky, Threads, Mastodon, MySpace, Friendster, and I'm sure 1,000 more.